At the window, he stood watching her, his eyebrows pulled together into waves of compassion, his tongue fondling the worn gold in his upper jaw. He saw the girl bending down to the sleeping dog, who, at her touch, opened one liquid eye, matted in the corners with what looked like green glue. She reached out and touched the dog's head, stroking him gently. She placed the meat on the floor of the porch, near his nose. The odor roused him. He lifted his head and got up to smell it better. He ate it in 3 or 4 gulps. The girl stroked his head again, and the dog looked up at her with soft, triangle eyes. Suddenly he coughed, the cough of a phlegmy old man, and got to his feet. The girl jumped. The dog gagged, his mouth chomping the air, and promptly fell down. He tried to raise himself, could not, tried again, and half fell down the steps. Choking, stumbling, he moved like a broken toy around the yard. The girl's mouth was open, a little petal of tongue showing. She made a wild, pointless gesture with one hand, and then covered her mouth with both hands. She was trying not to vomit. The dog fell again, a spasm jerking his body. Then he was quiet. The girl's hands covering her mouth, she backed away a few feet, then turned, ran out of the yard, and down the walk. Soaphead Church went to the table. He sat down, with folded hands, balancing his forehead on the balls of his thumbs. Then he rose and went to a tiny night table with a drawer, from which he took paper and a fountain pen. A bottle of ink was on the same shelf that held the poison. With these things, he sat again at the table, slowly, carefully, relishing his penmanship. He wrote the following letter. Attention. To he who greatly ennobled human nature by creating it. Dear God, the purpose of this letter is to familiarize you with facts which either have escaped your notice or which you have chosen to ignore. Once upon a time, I lived greenly and youngish on one of your islands, an island of the archipelago in the South Atlantic, between North and South America, enclosing the Caribbean Sea and the Gulf of Mexico, divided into the Greater Antilles, the Lesser Antilles, and the Bahama Islands. Not the Windward or Leeward Island colonies, mark you, but within, of course, the greater of the two Antilles. While the precision of my prose may be, at times, laborious, it is necessary that I identify myself to you clearly. Now, we in this colony took as our own the most dramatic and the most obvious of our white masters' characteristics, which were, of course, their worst. In retaining the identity of our race, we held fast to those characteristics most gratifying to sustain and least troublesome to maintain. Consequently, we were not royal, but snobbish. Not aristocratic, but class-conscious. We believed authority was cruelty to our inferiors, and education was being at school. We mistook violence for passion, indolence for leisure, and thought recklessness was freedom. We raised our children and reared our crops. We let infants grow and property develop. Our manhood was defined by acquisitions, our womanhood by acquiescence. And the smell of your fruit and the labor of your days we abhorred. This morning, before the little black girl came, I cried for Velma. Oh, not aloud. There is no wind to carry bare or even refuse to bear a sound so heavy with regret. But in my silent, own, lone way, I cried for Velma. You need to know about Velma to understand what I did today. She, Velma, left me the way people leave a hotel room. A hotel room is a place to be when you're doing something else. Of itself, it is of no consequence to one's major scheme. A hotel room is convenient, but its convenience is limited to the time you need it while you are in that particular town, on that particular business. You hope it's comfortable, but prefer rather that it be anonymous. It is not, after all, where you live. When you no longer need it, you pay a little something for its use. Say, thank you, sir. And when your business in that town is over, you go away from that room. Does anybody regret leaving a hotel room? Does anybody who has a home, a real home somewhere, want to stay there? Does anybody look back with affection or even disgust at a hotel room when they leave it? You can only love or despise whatever living was done in that room. But the room itself? But you take a souvenir. Not to remember the room. To remember, rather, the time and the place of your business, your adventure. What can anyone feel for a hotel room? One doesn't any more feel for a hotel room than one expects a hotel room to feel for its occupant. That heavenly, heavenly Father was how she left me. Or rather, she never left me, because she was never, ever there. You remember, do you, how and of what we are made? Let me tell you now about the breasts of little girls. I apologize for the inappropriateness, is that it? The imbalance of loving them at awkward times of day and in awkward places, and the tastelessness of loving those which belong to members of my family. Do I have to apologize for loving strangers? But you too are amiss here, Lord. How? Why did you allow it to happen? How is it I could lift my eyes from the contemplation of your body and fall deeply into the contemplation of theirs? The buds on some of these saplings. They were mean, you know. Mean and tender. Mean little buds resisting the touch, springing like rubber, but aggressive, daring me to touch, commanding me to touch, not a bit shy, as you suppose. They stuck out at me, oh yes, at me. Slender-chested, finger-chested lassies. Have you ever seen them, Lord? I mean, really seen them? One could not see them and not love them. You, who made them, must have considered them lovely, even as an idea. How much more lovely is the manifestation of that idea? I couldn't, as you must recall, keep my hands, my mouth off them. Salt sweet, like not quite ripe strawberries, covered with the light, salt sweat of running days and hopping, skipping, jumping hours. The love of them, the touch, taste, and feel of them was not just an easy, luxurious human vice. They were for me a thing to do instead. Instead of Papa, instead of the cloth, instead of Velma, and I chose not to do without them. But I didn't go into the church, at least I didn't do that. As to what I did do, I told people I knew all about you, that I had received your powers. It was not a complete lie, but it was a complete lie. I should never have, I admit, I should never have taken their money in exchange for well-phrased, well-placed, well-faced lies. But mark you, I hated it. Not for a moment did I love the lies or the money. But consider the woman who left the hotel room. Consider the green time, the noontime of the archipelago. Consider their hopeful eyes that were outdone only by their hoping breasts. Consider how I needed a comfortable evil to prevent my knowing what I could not bear to know. Consider how I hated and despised the money. And now consider, not according to my just deserts, but according to my mercy, the little black girl that came a-looming at me today. Tell me, Lord, how could you leave a lass so long, so lone, that she could find her way to me? How could you? I weep for you, Lord, and it is because I weep for you that I had to do your work for you. Do you know what she came for? Blue eyes. New blue eyes, she said, like she was buying shoes. I'd like a pair of new blue eyes. She must have asked you for them for a very long time, and you hadn't replied. A habit, I could have told her, a long ago habit, broken for Job, but no more. She came to me for them. She had one of my cards, card enclosed. By the way, I added the Micah, Elihu Micah Whitcomb, but I am called Soaphead Church. I cannot remember how or why I got the name. What makes one name more a person than another? Is the name the real thing then? And the person only what his name says? Is that why, to the simplest and friendliest of questions, what is your name put to you by Moses, you would not say, and said instead, I am who I am? Like Popeye? I am what I am? Afraid you were, weren't you, to give out your name? Afraid they would know the name, and then know you? Then they wouldn't fear you? It's quite all right. Don't be vexed. I mean no offense. I understand. I have been a bad man, too, and an unhappy man, too. But someday I will die. I was always so kind. Why do I have to die? The little girls. The little girls are the only things I'll miss. Do you know that when I touched their sturdy little tits and bit them just a little, I felt I was being friendly. I didn't want to kiss their mouths or sleep in the bed with them or take a child bride for my own. Playful, I felt, and friendly. Not like the newspaper said, not like the people whispered, and they didn't mind at all, not at all. Remember how so many of them came back? No one would even try to understand that. If I'd been hurting them, would they have come back? Two of them, Doreen and Sugar Babe, they'd come together. I gave them mints, money, and they'd eat ice cream with their legs open while I played with them. It was like a party, and there wasn't nastiness, and there wasn't any filth, and there wasn't any odor, and there wasn't any groaning, just the light, white laughter of little girls and me. And there wasn't any look, any long, funny look, any long, funny Velma look afterward. No look that makes you feel dirty afterward, that makes you want to die. With little girls, it is all clean and good and friendly. You have to understand that, Lord. You said, suffer little children to come unto me and harm them not. Did you forget? Did you forget about the children? Yes, you forgot. You let them go wanting, sit on road shoulders, crying next to their dead mothers. I've seen them, charred, lame, halt. You forgot, Lord. You forgot how and when to be God. That's why I changed the little black girl's eyes for her, and I didn't touch her. Not a finger did I lay on her. But I gave her those blue eyes she wanted. Not for pleasure and not for money. I did what you did not, could not, would not do. I looked at that ugly little black girl, and I loved her. I played you, and it was a very good show. I have caused a miracle. I gave her the eyes. I gave her the blue, blue, two blue eyes. Cobalt blue. A streak of it, right out of your own blue heaven. No one else will see her blue eyes, but she will. And she will live happily ever after. I have found it meet and right so to do. Now you are jealous. You are jealous of me. You see, I too have created, not aboriginally like you, but creation is a heady wine, more for the taster than the brewer. Having therefore imbibed, as it were, of the nectar, I'm not afraid of you, of death, not even of life. And it's all right about Velma. And it's all right about Papa. And it's all right about the greater and the lesser Antilles. Quite all right. Quite. With kindest regards, I remain your Elihu Micah Whitcomb. Soaphead Church folded the sheets of paper into three equal parts, and slipped them into an envelope. Although he had no seal, he longed for sealing wax. He removed a cigar box from under the bed and rummaged about in it. There were some of his most precious things. A sliver of jade that had dislodged from a cufflink at the Chicago Hotel. A gold pendant shaped like a Y, with a piece of coral attached to it that had belonged to the mother he never knew. 4 large hairpins that Velma had left on the rim of the bathroom sink. A powder blue grosgrain ribbon from the head of a little girl named Precious Jewel. A blackened faucet head from the sink in a jail cell in Cincinnati. 2 marbles he had found under a bench in Morningside Park on a very fine spring day. An old Lucky Heart catalog that smelled still of nut brown and mocha face powder and lemon vanishing cream. Distracted by his things, he forgot what he had been looking for. The effort to recall was too great. There was a buzzing in his head, and a wash of fatigue overcame him. He closed his box, eased himself out on the bed, and slipped into an ivory sleep from which he could not hear the tiny yelps of an old lady who had come out of her candy store and found the still carcass of an old dog named Bob. Summer. I have only to break into the tightness of a strawberry, and I see summer, its dust and lowering skies. It remains for me a season of storms. The parched days and sticky nights are undistinguished in my mind, but the storms, the violent sudden storms, both frightened and quenched me. But my memory is uncertain. I recall a summer storm in the town where we lived, and imagine a summer my mother knew in 1929. There was a tornado that year, she said, that blew away half of South Lorraine. I mix up her summer with my own, biting the strawberry, thinking of storms. I see her, a slim young girl in a pink crepe dress. One hand is on her hip, the other lolls about her thigh, waiting. The wind swoops her up high above the houses, but she is still standing, hand on hip, smiling. The anticipation and promise in her lolling hand are not altered by the Holocaust. In the summer tornado of 1929, my mother's hand is unextinguished. She is strong, smiling, and relaxed while the world falls down about her. So much for memory. Public fact becomes private reality, and the seasons of a Midwestern town become the moiré of our small lives. The summer was already thick when Frida and I received our seeds. We had waited since April for the magic package containing the packets and packets of seeds we were to sell for 5 cents each, which would entitle us to a new bicycle. We believed it and spent a major part of every day trooping about the town selling them. Although Mama had restricted us to the homes of people she knew or the neighborhoods familiar to us, we knocked on all doors and floated in and out of every house that opened to us. 12-room houses that sheltered half as many families, smelling of grease and urine. Tiny wooden 4-room houses tucked into bushes near the railroad tracks. The up-over places, apartments, up-over fish markets, butcher shops, furniture stores, saloons, restaurants. Tidy brick houses with flowered carpets and glass bowls with fluted edges. During that summer of the seed selling, we thought about the money, thought about the seeds, and listened with only half an ear to what people were saying. In the houses of people who knew us, we were asked to come in and sit, given cold water or lemonade. And while we sat there, being refreshed, the people continued their conversations or went about their chores. Little by little, we began to piece a story together, a secret, terrible, awful story. And it was only after 2 or 3 such vaguely overheard conversations that we realized that the story was about Picola. Properly placed, the fragments of talk ran like this. Did you hear about that girl? What? Pregnant? Yes, but guess who? Who? I don't know all these little old boys. That's just it. Ain't no little old boy. They say it's Charlie. Charlie? Her daddy? Uh-huh. Lord have mercy. That dirty nigger. Remember that time he tried to burn him up? I knew he was crazy for sure then. What's she gonna do, the mama? Keep on like she been, I reckon. He taken off. County ain't gonna let her keep that baby, is they? Don't know. None of them breed loves seem right anyhow. That boy is off somewhere every minute, and the girl was always foolish. Don't nobody know nothing about them anyway, where they come from or nothing. Don't seem to have no people. What you reckon make him do a thing like that? Beats me, just nasty. Well, they ought to take her out of school. Ought to. She carries some of the blame. Oh, come on. She ain't but 12 or so. Yeah, but you never know. How come she didn't fight him? Maybe she did. Yeah, you never know. Well, it probably won't live. They say the way her mama beat her, she lucky to be alive herself. She'd be lucky if it don't live. Bound to be the ugliest thing walking. Can't help but be. Ought to be a law. Two ugly people doubling up like that to make more ugly. Be better off in the ground. Well, I wouldn't worry none. It'd be a miracle if it live. Our astonishment was short-lived, for it gave way to a curious kind of defensive shame. We were embarrassed for Piccola, hurt for her, and finally, we just felt sorry for her. Our sorrow drove out all thoughts of the new bicycle, and I believe our sorrow was the more intense because nobody else seemed to share it. They were disgusted, amused, shocked, outraged, or even excited by the story. But we listened for the one who would say, "Poor little girl," or "Poor baby." But there was only head wagging where those words should have been. We looked for eyes creased with concern, but saw only veils. I thought about the baby that everybody wanted dead, and I saw it very clearly. It was in a dark, wet place, its head covered with great O's of wool, the black face holding, like nickels, two clean black eyes, the flared nose, kissing thick lips, and the living, breathing silk of black skin. No synthetic yellow bangs suspended over the marble blue eyes, no pinched nose and bowline mouth. More strongly than my fondness for Piccola, I felt a need for someone to want the black baby to live, just to counteract the universal love of white baby dolls, Shirley Temples and Maureen Peels. And Frieda must have felt the same thing. We did not think of the fact that Piccola was not married. Lots of girls had babies who were not married, and we did not dwell on the fact that the baby's father was Piccola's father too. The process of having a baby by any male was incomprehensible to us. At least she knew her father. We thought only of this overwhelming hatred for the unborn baby. We remembered Mrs. Breedlove knocking Piccola down and soothing the pink tears of the frozen doll baby that sounded like the door of our icebox. We remembered the knuckled eyes of schoolchildren under the gaze of meringue pie and the eyes of these same children when they looked at Piccola. Or maybe we didn't remember. We just knew. We had defended ourselves since memory against everything and everybody, considered all speech a code to be broken by us, and all gestures subject to careful analysis. We had become headstrong, devious, and arrogant. Nobody paid us any attention, so we paid very good attention to ourselves. Our limitations were not known to us, not then. Our only handicap was our size. People gave us orders because they were bigger and stronger. So it was with confidence, strengthened by pity and pride, that we decided to change the course of events and alter a human life. What we gonna do, Frieda? What can we do? Miss Johnson said it would be a miracle if it lived. So let's make it a miracle. Yeah, but how? We could pray. That's not enough. Remember last time with the bird? That was different. It was half dead when we found it. I don't care. I still think we have to do something really strong this time. Let's ask him to let Piccola's baby live and promise to be good for a whole month. Okay, but we better give up something so he'll know we really mean it this time. Give up what? We ain't got nothing. Nothing but the seed money, $2. We could give that. Or you know what? We could give up the bicycle, bury the money, and plant the seeds. all of the money? Claudia, do you want to do it or not? Okay. I just thought, okay. We have to do it right now. We'll bury the money over by her house so we can't go back and dig it up. And we'll plant the seeds out back of our house so we can watch over them. And when they come up, we'll know everything is all right. All right? All right. Only let me sing this time. You say the magic words. Look, look, here comes a friend. The friend will play with Jane. They will play a good game. Play, Jane. Play. How many times a minute are you going to look inside that old thing? I didn't look in a long time. You did too. So what? I can look if I want to. I didn't say you couldn't. I just don't know why you have to look every minute. They aren't going anywhere. I know it. I just like to look. You scared they might go away? Of course not. How can they go away? The others went away. They didn't go away, they changed. Go away, change. What's the difference? A lot. Mr. Soaphead said they would last forever. Forever and ever, amen? Yes, if you want to know. You don't have to be so smarty when you talk to me. I'm not being smarty, you started it. I'd just like to do something else besides watch you stare in that mirror. You're just jealous. I am not. You are. You wish you had them. Ha! What would I look like with blue eyes? Nothing much. If you're going to keep this up, I may as well go on off by myself. No, don't go. What do you want to do? We could go outside and play, I guess. But it's too hot. You can take your old mirror, put it in your coat pocket, and you could look at yourself up and down the street. Boy, I never would have thought you'd be so jealous. Oh, come on. You are. Are what? Jealous. Okay, so I'm jealous. See, I told you. No, I told you. Are they really nice? Yes. Very nice. Just very nice? Really, truly, very nice. Really, truly, bluely nice? Oh, God, you are crazy. I am not. I didn't mean it that way. Well, what did you mean? Come on, it's too hot in here. Wait a minute, I can't find my shoes. Here they are. Oh, thank you. Got your mirror? Yes, dearie. Well, let's go then. Ow! What's the matter? The sun is too bright. It hurts my eyes. Not mine. I don't even blink. Look, I can look right at the sun. Don't do that. Why not? It doesn't hurt. I don't even have to blink. Well, blink anyway. You make me feel funny, staring at the sun like that. Feel funny how? I don't know. Yes, you do. Feel funny how? I told you I don't know. Why don't you look at me when you say that? You look drop-eyed, like Mrs. Breedlove. Mrs. Breedlove looked drop-eyed at you? Yes, now she does. Ever since I got my blue eyes, she look away from me all of the time. Do you suppose she's jealous, too? Could be. They are pretty, you know. I know. He really did a good job. Everybody's jealous. Every time I look at somebody, they look off. Is that why nobody has told you how pretty they are? Sure it is. Can you imagine something like that happening to a person and nobody saying anything about it? They all try to pretend they don't see them. Isn't that funny? I said, isn't that funny? Yes. You are the only one who tells me how pretty they are. Yes. You are a real friend. I'm sorry about picking on you before. I mean, saying you were jealous and all. That's all right. No, really, you are my very best friend. Why didn't I know you before? You didn't need me before. Didn't need you? I mean, you were so unhappy before. I guess you didn't notice me before. I guess you're right. And I was so lonely for friends. And you were right here, right before my eyes. No, honey, right after your eyes. What? What does Maureen think about your eyes? She doesn't say anything about them. Has she said anything to you about them? No, nothing. Do you like Maureen? Oh, she's all right. For a half-white girl, that is. I know what you mean. But would you like to be her friend? I mean, would you like to go around with her at anything? No. Me neither. But she sure is popular. Who wants to be popular? Not me. Me neither. But you couldn't be popular anyway. You don't even go to school. You don't either. I know, but I used to. What did you stop for? They made me. Who made you? I don't know. After that first day at school, when I had my blue eyes? Well, the next day, they had Mrs. Breedlove come out. Now I don't go anymore. But I don't care. You don't? No, I don't. They're just prejudice, that's all. Yes, they sure are prejudiced. Just because I got blue eyes, bluer than theirs, they're prejudiced. That's right. They are bluer, aren't they? Oh, yes. Much bluer. Bluer than Joanna's? Much bluer than Joanna's. And bluer than Michelina's? Much bluer than Michelina's. I thought so. Did Michelina say anything to you about my eyes? No, nothing. Did you say anything to her? No. How come? How come what? How come you don't talk to anybody? I talk to you. Besides me. I don't like anybody besides you. Where do you live? I told you once. What is your mother's name? Why are you so busy meddling me? I just wondered. You don't talk to anybody. You don't go to school. And nobody talks to you. How do you know nobody talks to me? They don't. When you're in the house with me, even Mrs. Breedlove doesn't say anything to you. Ever. Sometimes I wonder if she even sees you. Why wouldn't she see me? I don't know. She almost walks right over you. Maybe she doesn't feel too good since Charlie's gone. Oh, yes, you must be right. She probably misses him. I don't know why she would. All he did was get drunk and beat her up. Well, you know how grown-ups are. Yes. No. How are they? Well, she probably loved him anyway. Him? Sure, why not? Anyway, if she didn't love him, she sure let him do it to her a lot. That's nothing. How do you know? I saw them all the time. She didn't like it. Then why'd she let him do it to her? Because he made her. How could somebody make you do something like that? Easy. Oh, yeah? How easy? They just make you, that's all. I guess you're right. And Charlie could make anybody do anything. He could not. He made you, didn't he? Shut up. I was only teasing. Shut up. Okay, okay. He just tried, see? He didn't do anything. You hear me? I'm shutting up. You'd better. I don't like that kind of talk. I said I'm shutting up. You always talk so dirty. Who told you about that, anyway? I forget. Sammy? No, you did. I did not. You did. You said he tried to do it to you when you were sleeping on the couch. See there? You don't even know what you're talking about. It was when I was washing dishes. Oh, yes, dishes. By myself, in the kitchen. Well, I'm glad you didn't let him. Yes. Did you? Did I what? Let him. Now who's crazy? I am, I guess. You sure are. Still. Well, go ahead. Still what? I wonder what it would be like. Horrible. Really? Yes, horrible. Then why didn't you tell Mrs. Breedlove? I did tell her. I don't mean about the first time. I mean about the second time. When you were sleeping on the couch. I wasn't sleeping. I was reading. You don't have to shout. You don't understand anything, do you? She didn't even believe me when I told her. So that's why you didn't tell her about the second time. She wouldn't have believed me then either. You're right. No use telling her when she wouldn't believe you. That's what I'm trying to get through your thick head. Okay, I understand now. Just about. What do you mean, just about? You sure are mean today. You keep on saying mean and sneaky things. I thought you were my friend. I am. I am. Then leave me alone about Charlie. Okay. There's nothing more to say about him anyway. He's gone anyway. Yes. Good riddance. Yes, good riddance. And Sammy's gone too. And Sammy's gone too. So there's no use talking about it. I mean them. No. No use at all. It's all over now. Yes. And you don't have to be afraid of Charlie coming at you anymore. No. That was horrible, wasn't it? Yes. The second time, too? Yes. Really? The second time, too? Leave me alone. You better leave me alone. Can't you take a joke? I was only funning. I don't like to talk about dirty things. Me neither. Let's talk about something else. What? What will we talk about? Why, your eyes. Oh, yes. My eyes. My blue eyes. Let me look again. See how pretty they are? Yes. They get prettier each time I look at them. They're the prettiest I've ever seen. Really? Oh, yes. Prettier than the sky? Oh, yes. Much prettier than the sky. Prettier than Alice and Jerry's storybook eyes? Oh, yes. Much prettier than Alice and Jerry's storybook eyes. And prettier than Joanna's? Oh, yes. And bluer, too. Bluer than Michelina's? Yes. Are you sure? Of course I'm sure. You don't sound sure. Well, I am sure. Unless what? Oh, nothing. I was just thinking about a lady I saw yesterday. Her eyes sure were blue. But no, not bluer than yours. Are you sure? Yes, I remember them now. Yours are bluer. I'm glad. Me too. I'd hate to think there was anybody around with bluer eyes than yours. I'm sure there isn't. Not around here, anyway. But you don't know, do you? You haven't seen everybody, have you? No, I haven't. So there could be, couldn't there? Not hardly. But maybe. Maybe. You said around here. Nobody around here probably has bluer eyes. What about someplace else? Even if my eyes are bluer than Joanna's, and bluer than Michelina's, and bluer than that lady's you saw, suppose there is somebody way off somewhere with bluer eyes than mine. Don't be silly. There could be, couldn't there? Not hardly. But suppose a long way off, in Cincinnati, say, There is somebody whose eyes are bluer than mine. Suppose there are two people with bluer eyes. So what? You asked for blue eyes. You got blue eyes. He should have made them bluer.
Who?
Mr. Soaphead. Did you say what color blue you wanted them?
No, I forgot.
Oh, well. Look. Look over there. At that girl. Look at her eyes. Are they bluer than mine?
No, I don't think so.
Did you look real good?
Yes.
Here comes someone. Look at his. See if they're bluer.
You're being silly. I'm not going to look at everybody's eyes.
You have to.
No, I don't.
Please. If there is somebody with bluer eyes than mine, then maybe there is somebody with the bluest eyes. The bluest eyes in the whole world.
That's just too bad, isn't it? Please help me look.
No. But suppose my eyes aren't blue enough.
Blue enough for what?
Blue enough for, I don't know.
Blue enough for something.
Blue enough for you.
I'm not going to play with you anymore.
Oh, don't leave me.
Yes, I am.
Why? Are you mad at me?
Yes.
Because my eyes aren't blue enough?
Because I don't have the bluest eyes?
No, because you're acting silly. Don't go. Don't leave me.
Will you come back if I get them?
Get what?
The bluest eyes.
Will you come back then?
Of course I will.
I'm just going away for a little while.
You promise?
Sure.
I'll be back.
Right before your very eyes.
So it was. A little black girl yearns for the blue eyes of a little white girl. And the horror at the heart of her yearning is exceeded only by the evil of fulfillment. We saw her sometimes, Frida and I, after the baby came too soon and died, after the gossip and the slow wagging of heads. She was so sad to see. Grown people looked away, children, those who were not frightened by her, laughed outright. The damage done was total. She spent her days, her tendril, sap green days, walking up and down, her head jerking to the beat of a drummer so distant only she could hear. Elbows bent, hands on shoulders, she flailed her arms like a bird in an eternal, grotesquely futile effort to fly, beating the air, a winged but grounded bird, intent on the blue void, could not even see, but which filled the valleys of the mind. We tried to see her without looking at her, and never, never went near. Not because she was absurd or repulsive, or because we were frightened, but because we had failed her. Our flowers never grew. I was convinced that Frida was right, that I had planted them too deeply. How could I have been so sloven? So we avoided Pico the Breedlove forever. And the years folded up like pocket handkerchiefs. Sammy left town long ago. Charlie died in the workhouse. Mrs. Breedlove still does housework, and Picola is somewhere in that little brown house she and her mother moved to on the edge of town, where you can see her even now once in a while. The bird-like gestures are worn away to a mere picking and plucking her way between the tire rims and the sunflowers, between Coke bottles and milkweed, among all the waste and beauty of the world, which is what she herself was. All of our waste, which we dumped on her, and which she absorbed. And all of our beauty, which was hers first, and which she gave to us. All of us, all who knew her, felt so wholesome after we cleaned ourselves on her. We were so beautiful when we stood astride her ugliness. Her simplicity decorated us. Her guilt sanctified us. Her pain made us glow with health. Her awkwardness made us think we had a sense of humor. Her inarticulateness made us believe we were eloquent. Her poverty kept us generous. Even her waking dreams we used to silence our own nightmares. And she led us, and thereby deserved our contempt. We honed our egos on her, padded our characters with her frailty, and yawned in the fantasy of our strength. And fantasy it was, for we were not strong, only aggressive. We were not free, merely licensed. We were not compassionate, we were polite, not good, but well-behaved. We courted death in order to call ourselves brave and hid like thieves from life. We substituted good grammar for intellect. We switched habits to simulate maturity. We rearranged lies and called it truth, seeing in the new pattern of an old idea the revelation and the word. She, however, stepped over into madness, a madness which protected her from us, simply because it bored us in the end. Oh, some of us loved her. The Maginot Line. And Charlie loved her, I'm sure he did. He, at any rate, was the one who loved her enough to touch her, envelop her, give something of himself to her. But his touch was fatal, and the something he gave her filled the matrix of her agony with death. Love is never any better than a lover. Wicked people love wickedly. Violent people love violently. Weak people love weakly. Stupid people love stupidly. But the love of a free man is never safe. There is no gift for the beloved. The lover alone possesses his gift of love. The loved one is shorn, neutralized, frozen in the glare of the lover's inward eye. And now when I see her searching the garbage, for what? The thing we assassinated? I talk about how I did not plant the seeds too deeply, how it was the fault of the earth, the land of our town. I even think now that the land of the entire country was hostile to marigolds that year. This soil is bad for certain kinds of flowers. Certain seeds it will not nurture. Certain fruit it will not bear. And when the land kills of its own volition, we acquiesce and say the victim had no right to live. We are wrong, of course, but it doesn't matter. It's too late. At least on the edge of my town, among the garbage and the sunflowers of my town, it's much, much, much too late. Author's note. There can't be anyone, I'm sure, who doesn't know what it feels like to be disliked, even rejected, momentarily or for sustained periods of time. Perhaps the feeling is merely indifference, mild annoyance, but it may also be hurt. It may even be that some of us know what it is like to be actually hated, hated for things we have no control over and cannot change. When this happens, it is some consolation to know that the dislike or hatred is unjustified, that you don't deserve it. And if you have the emotional strength and or support from family and friends, the damage is reduced or erased. We think of it as the stress, minor or disabling, that is part of life as a human. When I began writing The Bluest Eye, I was interested in something else, not resistance to the contempt of others, ways to deflect it, but the far more tragic and disabling consequences of accepting rejection as legitimate, as self-evident. I knew that some victims of powerful self-loathing turn out to be dangerous, violent, reproducing the enemy who has humiliated them over and over. Others surrender their identity, melt into a structure that delivers the strong persona they lack. Most others, however, grow beyond it. But there are some who collapse, silently, anonymously, with no voice to express or acknowledge it. They are invisible. The death of self-esteem can occur quickly, easily, in children, before their ego has legs, so to speak. Couple the vulnerability of youth with indifferent parents, dismissive adults, and a world which, in its language, laws, and images, reinforces despair, and the journey to destruction is sealed. The project, then, for this, my first book, was to enter the life of the one least likely to withstand such damaging forces because of youth, gender, and race. Begun as a bleak narrative of psychological murder, the main character could not stand alone, since her passivity made her a narrative void. So I invented friends, classmates, who understood, even sympathized with her plight, but had the benefit of supportive parents and a feistiness all their own. Yet they were helpless as well. They could not save their friend from the world. She broke. The origin of the novel lay in a conversation I had with a childhood friend. We had just started elementary school. She said she wanted blue eyes. I looked around to picture her with them and was violently repelled by what I imagined she would look like if she had her wish. The sorrow in her voice seemed to call for sympathy, and I faked it for her. But astonished by the desecration she proposed, I got mad at her instead. Until that moment, I had seen the pretty, the lovely, the nice, the ugly, and although I had certainly used the word beautiful, I had never experienced its shock, the force of which was equaled by the knowledge that no one recognized it, not even or especially the one who possessed it. It must have been more than the face I was examining. The silence of the street in the early afternoon, the light, the atmosphere of confession. In any case, it was the first time I knew beautiful, had imagined it for myself. Beauty was not simply something to behold. It was something one could do. The Bluest Eye was my effort to say something about that, to say something about why she had not, or possibly ever would have, the experience of what she possessed, and also why she prayed for so radical an alteration. Implicit in her desire was racial self-loathing. And 20 years later, I was still wondering about how one learns that. Who told her? Who made her feel that it was better to be a freak than what she was? Who had looked at her and found her so wanting, so small a weight on the beauty scale? The novel pecks away at the gaze that condemned her. The reclamation of racial beauty in the 60s
stirred these thoughts and made me think about the necessity for the claim. Why, although reviled by others, could this beauty not be taken for granted within the community? Why did it need wide public articulation to exist? These are not clever questions. But in 1962, when I began this story, and in 1965, when it began to be a book, the answers were not as obvious to me as they quickly became and are now. The assertion of racial beauty was not a reaction to the self-mocking, humorous critique of cultural, racial foibles common in all groups, but against the damaging internalization of assumptions of immutable inferiority originating in an outside gaze. I focused, therefore, on how something as grotesque as the demonization of an entire race could take root inside the most delicate member of society, a child, the most vulnerable member, a female. In trying to dramatize the devastation that even casual racial contempt can cause, I chose a unique situation, not a representative one. The extremity of Picola's case stemmed largely from a crippled and crippling family, unlike the average black family and unlike the narrator's. But singular as Picola's life was, I believed some aspects of her woundability were lodged in all young girls. In exploring the social and domestic aggression that could cause a child to literally fall apart, I mounted a series of rejections, some routine, some exceptional, some monstrous, all the while trying hard to avoid complicity in the demonization process Picola was subjected to. That is, I did not want to dehumanize the characters who trashed Picola and contributed to her collapse. One problem was centering the weight of the novel's inquiry on so delicate and vulnerable a character could smash her and lead readers into the comfort of pitying her rather than into an interrogation of themselves for the smashing. My solution, break the narrative into parts that had to be reassembled by the reader, seemed to me a good idea, the execution of which does not satisfy me now. Besides, it didn't work. Many readers remained touched, but not moved. The other problem, of course, was language. Holding the despising glance while sabotaging it was difficult. The novel tried to hit the raw nerve of racial self-contempt, expose it, then soothe it, not with narcotics, but with language that replicated the agency I discovered in my first experience of beauty. Because that moment was so racially infused, my revulsion at what my school friend wanted, very blue eyes and a very black skin, the harm she was doing to my concept of the beautiful, the struggle was for writing that was indisputably black. I don't yet know quite what that is, but neither that nor the attempts to disqualify an effort to find out keeps me from trying to pursue it. My choices of language, speakerly, oral, colloquial, my reliance for full comprehension on codes embedded in black culture, my effort to effect immediate co-conspiracy and intimacy without any distancing explanatory fabric, as well as my attempts to shape a silence while breaking it, are attempts to transfigure the complexity and wealth of black American culture into a language worthy
of the culture. Thinking back now on the problems expressive language presented to me, I am amazed by their currency, their tenacity. Hearing civilized language debase humans, watching cultural exorcisms debase literature, seeing oneself preserved in the amber of disqualifying metaphors, I can say that my narrative project is as difficult today as it was then.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison. This program was directed by Robert Kessler. Producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 1970 and 1998 by Toni Morrison. Author's note text copyright 1993 and 2007 by Toni Morrison. Production copyright 2011, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.